and strengthen Islamic governance system here.
The Taliban's move to appoint 17 new top government officials comes as the group's leadership had already pledged to establish an inclusive government. However, many here in Afghanistan believe the symbolic presence of some officials on behalf of some ethnic groups does not mean that the Taliban is trying to form an inclusive government.
We are waiting for establishment of a real inclusive government, and Taliban must accept such demand of the nation. This is because we are facing serious challenges such as joblessness and poverty.
In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman says the current government is an interim one and that works are underway to establish an inclusive government. According to the group, the future Afghan government will convince the world to recognize the Taliban-appointed government as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. The Taliban are struggling to form their government, while the resistance front in Panjshir Valley says it will never accept the rule of the Taliban over Afghanistan unless they say yes to the main demands of Afghans, demands such as forming a real inclusive government that does not deprive women and girls of their basic rights and paying respect to social and cultural liberties of people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
According to the results of parliamentary elections in Russia, United Russia ruling party received a constitutional majority in the State Duma. The Communist Party took the second place, with the Liberal Democratic Party the third one. Then goes Fair Russia and New People. Thus, these five parties overcome the 5% barrier to enter the State Duma. United Russia is promoting President Vladimir Putin's agenda, which is also enshrined in last year's social amendments to the Constitution.
I want to thank all our voters who voted for United Russia and our candidates. This is a great trust and no less great responsibility for us. I also want to thank those who voted for other political parties. We respect your position and the choice you made.
The State Duma is elected in Russia for a five-year term under a mixed system. 225 deputies, according to party lists, another 225 in single-mandate constituencies in one round. The results haven't been without controversy, however. There have been widespread accusations of fraud and misconduct. Throughout the 3 days of voting, many videos shared online appeared to show voters and officials stuffing ballot boxes with multiple voting slips. In Moscow, some opposition figures accused officials of delaying the release of online voting results to give them an opportunity to manipulate. In response, Kremlin hailed the parliamentary elections as open, competitive, and honest.
Voter turnout was notably high, especially on the last day of voting. This election will also be remembered by a large number of candidates.
The team of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny accused the authorities of foul play, declaring all the victories against his candidates they supported as part of a controversial smart voting scheme as falsification. Earlier before the elections, Russia's telecom watchdog demanded the Navalny app be removed from App Store and Google Play based on a ruling by the Russian Prosecutor General's office.
For the first time this year's federal elections in Russia took place over 3 days. This year, election organizers have also introduced electronic voting devices. So far, residents of only seven regions in Russia have been able to vote using these devices. According to the Constitution, the new State Duma should meet on the 30th day following the election day.
But the president has the right to convene the first meeting of the lower house of parliament even earlier than this date. The Russian president has already exercised this right after previous elections. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The issue centers around a contract signed 5 years ago worth up to 50 billion euro for France to build 12 submarines for Australia. Out of the blue, Paris found out a few days ago that the deal is off. France is furious, and so too is the EU. Talks on a new trade deal between the 27-nation bloc and Australia took place in June and were due to resume in October. We're told that's now in doubt.
We are analysing the impact of the AUKUS announcement and what this impact could be on this schedule.
AUKUS is a new security deal signed between the US, Britain and Australia. It means France's submarines are no longer acquired. The country's foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, says it's a stab in the back from allies.
There will be consequences, of course, for the French relationship with the US, with Australia, with the UK, but that also implies there will be consequences for the relationship between the EU and these countries.
Senior EU ministers will discuss their response to the diplomatic crisis in the early hours of Tuesday morning, Brussels time.
There will be a meeting of EU 27 foreign ministers chaired by HMVP Borrell in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly.
Paris has already withdrawn its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. The AUKUS nuclear submarines will use the latest undersea technologies in the South China Sea. Beijing says the move smacks of Cold War mentality. North Korea warns it could trigger a nuclear arms race. Political analysts are suggesting Australia and Britain need to be very circumspect when dealing with the US. They point to all the international agreements Trump pulled the plug on. Also, Biden indicated he would rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. That still hasn't happened. And look at the impact of US unilateral decisions with respect to Afghanistan. Many are asking, can Washington really be trusted? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A lengthy parliamentary session was held in Beirut to discuss the cabinet manifesto and give the Miqati cabinet a vote of confidence. The session began with an address by the Prime Minister, who briefed the members of parliament on the most significant issues which will be dealt with.
The socio-economic challenges should be among our top priorities. The government has no way but to put its focus on reforms to pave the way for uplifting the economy, developing the productive sectors, and attracting foreign investment. In addition to these files, we need to have an independent judicial body.
Prime Minister stressed that his cabinet will directly begin negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, and its main objective will include the general reforms and a restructuring of the banking sector. In light of Lebanon's current dire economic descent, the majority of Lebanese lawmakers decided to give a confidence vote to a cabinet which considers itself in a state of relief efforts.
We want to give Lebanon a chance to recover and to stop the collapse that is happening, the free fall that is happening, actually. And this is why we're giving it a chance, actually, based on also a program that we discussed with the Prime Minister and that included a lot of the requirements and the requests we have put in it.
Miqati's 24-member cabinet is also expected to offer solutions to shortages of medicine and fuel and to launch a social welfare card as a compensation for the local currency's lost value.
The government is expected to address all of these problems together, but they have to prioritize the problems. The Lebanese now, the mere Lebanese, the lay Lebanese, and the majority of the Lebanese are not capable of meeting their basic needs in order to survive. So we pin the hopes on the government to be able to prioritize the needs of the people and to address the most important. When we talk about the most important, we talk about the financial crisis, we talk about correcting the level of the wages for the Lebanese, or even to give a compensation so they can meet their basic needs.
The Miqati cabinet has vowed to prepare for parliamentary elections and hold them on time in May of 2022. The Miqati cabinet has stressed in its manifesto that now is the time for action and not words. The lawmakers, for their part, have considered that this government and all future cabinets must work on rebuilding the economy instead of relying on grants and loans. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos, considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Protesters set up a cage outside Denmark's embassy in Iran, a cage with a cake inside to celebrate the fifth birthday of Dariush. This is the second year in a row that Dariush's mother, Mahsa, celebrates her son's birthday without him, as Dariush has been taken away from his family by the Copenhagen municipality for parental incompetence reasons, something which the distraught mom dismisses as unfair. She says she misses her son.
My son suffers from autism, but the Danish authorities blame me for all of my son's disorders, like inability to sleep or eat. I was even referred to a pediatrician who approved that my son is an autistic. But the authorities in Denmark refused to accept the reality and accused me of misbehavior toward my child. I urge the Iranian government and the foreign ministry to take measures so I can see my son again.
Mahsa has lived in Denmark for 6 years, but does not have the Danish permanent residency. She says she and her husband have both agreed to return to Iran, but Copenhagen refuses to grant them their son's custody. Rights activists here demand that the Danish government help Mahsa reunite with her son.
In every country, the law says that if a family is unfit to keep in the custody of their children, the government must remove the children from that family. But regarding Mahsa's case, the Danish government needs to hand the affected child to the relative Iranian entities to take care of the issue. Because Mahsa does not have a permanent Danish residency, and the case should be delegated to her country of origin.
While it was not possible for journalists and Mahsa to reach the Danish embassy to investigate the matter, Mahsa says she continues to publicize her cause and try any available legal channel to take her son back.
Apparently, it takes a lengthy and complicated legal procedure for Mahsa to get to her son. But what's clear is that 5-year-old Dariush is now living far from his mom, and nothing can replace the peaceful bosom of a mother for a child. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two,
Hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, in his first address to the UNGA, says the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have failed miserably. He referred to two incidents that represented how the U.S. is on a downward spiral. For this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at what these two incidents that he was referring to are, and how Raisi's mistrust of the U.S. and the U.S. failure of lifting the sanctions will affect the future of the talks.
As the 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. President, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We're working with the P5 plus one to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States' hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appeared to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
Introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Said Mostafa Hoshchensh, who joins us. Also joining us is John White, writer and political analyst from Edinburgh.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and Said Mostafa Hoshchensh, let me first start with you. Generally speaking, I'm leaving this question open to you to explain to us what the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi means when he says the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have failed miserably.
Hello, thanks for having me. Well, the United States has been trying to impose its hegemonic rule and order in the Middle East, in West Asia, throughout the last several decades. Especially in the last two decades, they tried to impose their own order to force several countries into collapse. According to a Pentagon official, a top Pentagon official, when they invaded Afghanistan in 2001, they meant to force seven countries into chaos and collapse, including Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Sudan, and Somalia. And they somehow were successful with regard to six other countries, but not Iran, because when Iran realized the threat, the IRGC Quds Force and its top commander, Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, defused the U.S. plan for imposing its hegemonic rule in this part of the world. They've been looting energy supplies, but they wanted to exercise their greater Middle East plan to force countries into internal strife and, you know, wars, civil wars, so that Israel's protection would be secured. First, second, the U.S. could, you know, do a transition of its, you know, assets as well as forces and equipment to South China Sea and to the lands near China in order to pose risks to the Chinese to slow down their economy. Mm-hmm. Once they failed in the first step, they moved for the same goal through proxy warfare. Their allies, like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, admittedly launched a proxy warfare and a terrorist war on Iranian allies in Syria and Iraq, and they meant to do so against the Lebanese as well, in order to you know, weaken and topple Iranian allies in those countries. And again, when they were using Al-Qaeda as well as ISIL, according, you know, we have so many confessions made by former and present U.S. officials, including Joe Biden himself when he was vice president, as well as Martin Dempsey, who was the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, also Michael Flynn, as well as many others. They have all made this confession that U.S. allies caused this war of terrorism in the region, and the U.S. was in the know, they knew it, and they took no action in order to let them wear off the Iranian allies' power, and they were defused because of Qasem Soleimani and Iran, who stood against them and defused the threat.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, John White. I mean, there's some examples that Sayyid Mustafa Khrushchev made there, but there's two that the Iranian president of MRAC talked about, and this was at the UN General Assembly, his first address. One of them, he said, was the happened on January 6th when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, Americans, and two was the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August from the capital to Kabul. Mm-hmm. And he said that this is what the two incidents that stand out that show that the U.S. is down on a path of decline. Do you agree with him? Are these two significant incidents that point to that?
I agree with him in every particular. In its importance, President Raisi's speech today at the UN General Assembly belongs in the same category as speeches made to the UN General Assembly by the likes of Che Guevara, Yasser Arafat, Hugo Chavez, and President Vladimir Putin of Russia, because it is a speech in which he spoke pristine truth to power. And the difference between President Raisi's speech today and those other speeches is that he was speaking truth to a declining power, and he articulated that in scintillating fashion. And those two incidents are major signposts on the trajectory of that decline. The Capitol building invasion by thousands and thousands of Trump supporters proves beyond doubt that US society is imploding from within, and the panicked and humiliating retreat from Afghanistan after 20 years, $2.5 trillion spent, proves that the US is no longer to maintain hegemony via hard power means. This is a historic tipping point. The Iranian government understands that, and that was, as I say, articulated in scintillating fashion by President Raisi at the UN General Assembly today.
Well, Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh, one of the key words that Ibrahim Raisi used was expulsion. And he said the result of seeking hegemony has been blood spilling and instability, and ultimately defeat and escape. So the reference there, we can say two countries would be in that equation. One would be Iraq and one would be Afghanistan. But why is it important to make that differentiation in his eyes, do you think, that the U.S. was expelled? I mean, at this point, perhaps Iraq would be defined more in that category compared to Afghanistan, do you think?
Well, you know, if the U.S. could do that, they would stay in here and they would guarantee their interest. They would stay in Afghanistan and Iraq. But as my colleague said, after 20 years, look what they've done. They've been killing people, and they call it collateral damage. In a last-case scenario that they, by the way, admitted, they killed the family without even getting close to the so-called terrorists they were trying to hunt down, and in a drone operation. These drone operations have been, you know, being conducted all throughout the West Asian region, and they've been killing people. Some of them, you know, they admit, but some other, there are many others, thousands of other people have been killed, and they call them collateral damage. After killing so many people, and after sustaining thousands of, you know, casualties in the U.S. Army, and after spending nearly $8 trillion, they have earned nothing, and we all witnessed how they, you know, escaped from Afghanistan. They didn't have enough time even to get their weapons or you know, to save their own comrades and arm in the Afghanistan army. And also, in Iraq, something nearly similar to that would happen if they insisted, you know, on staying in there. They wanted to prolong the U.S. stay in Iraq, but just the other day, they said that they've come across and, you know, they've come up with some kind of agreement with the Iraqi government to decrease the number of forces in there. They have realized that their stay would eventually result in more damage to the U.S. Army forces as well as equipment. Now, what matters more than their, you know, hegemonic rule in here or their quest for hegemonic ruling over the West Asian region is the rift inside their own society. You know, we saw, and President Raisi said in the Capitol, we all saw how Americans raided the U.S. Congress, the House of the People, it was supposed to be. But this has not been, this has not ended, you know. It's really on the way, and as President Biden has proved to be a weak president in the eyes, at least, of his critics inside, we expect similar developments in future. As many American experts have admitted, the real problem and the demise of the U.S. comes from home. And that reminds me of what the Iranian Supreme Leader said months ago, that the Americans shouldn't worry abroad. They should first worry about a home, because if there is a real threat posed to them, it's by the people, by the American people.
John White, you made an interesting point, at least in my eyes, when you said that this was a very important, obviously, speech that the Iranian president made to the UN General Assembly, his first one, which in itself is important. But the question I have for you is, when Ibrahim Raisi speaks about how the U.S. is on the decline, how the U.S. hegemony is one of the reasons why it's led to its downfall, it goes a little bit out of the normal talk, perhaps, that maybe UN members are accustomed to hearing, especially the Western nations, i.e. the U.S. and maybe European nations. And my question to you is, do you think when Iran takes a stance, in this case, Ibrahim Raisi, and speaks along those lines, that these nations of the General Assembly, of the UN, actually understand, and do they agree with the stance that Iran has? Because Iran has made out to be the aggressor. One of the things that Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson said recently is that it is as if these countries have forgotten that it was Iran that complied with all of its obligations under the nuclear agreement and did not enjoy the benefits due to U.S. lawbreaking measures. So do the member countries understand U.S. position, Iranian position here?
Well, to the extent that they do is the extent to which they will thrive in this new world order that is now being established in front of our eyes, with the rise of China as a global superpower and its global leadership, with its astonishing Belt and Road Initiative, which is an investment-led transformational infrastructure program which is forging successful partnerships with governments all over the world, which is to be made distinct from the Western developmental model, which does not establish partnership per se, but clients and satellites at the end of bayonets and through coercion, with not partnership in mind, but exploitation in mind. The Iranian president's speech today, he was filled with wisdom and with defiance. And he knows that Iran is stronger in many ways than America, despite the difference in GDP, despite the difference in the size of the military, despite the huge sanctions that Iran is suffering, because a new alignment is taking place. The tectonic plates of geopolitical power are shifting, just as the Roman Empire had its Emperor Galba after its Emperor Nero, senile geriatric. The US has its own Emperor Galba in the shape of President Biden after its own Nero in the shape of President Trump. There are striking parallels between the fall of the Roman Empire and the fall of today's Rome emanating from Washington. I think more and more countries are waking up to the fact that America is a declining power, that it can't be trusted, that its word can't be trusted, that it breaks treaties willy-nilly, that it's not an upholder of international law, but a serial violator of international law. The fact that the Biden administration would dare set non-nuclear conditions on the resurrection of the JCPOA, i.e. Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's quote-unquote power projection in the region. So what the Americans are saying under Biden, not Donald Trump, under Biden, is that Iran is not allowed to have allies in the region in which it is located, but the Americans are allowed to have allies in that region in which it is not located, i.e. primarily Israel and Saudi Arabia. Such hypocrisy cannot be allowed to continue to stand. And the irony is, the historical irony is that a neocon project for a new American century, which 9/11 was a pretext for, to dominate the resource-rich regions of the world, primarily the Middle East, has only set in train the decline of the U.S. as a hegemonic power.
Indeed, that PNAC project did not go too well, even though the length of time and its span was pretty long. Let's see here. A lot of talk has been made, a lot of projections are being made, or a lot of conclusions are being made as to the statements made by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, which direction the nuclear talks are going to go. For example, he has said that there's no trust in the U.S. He said that Iran has no trust in U.S. promises, and he said that he wants all anti-Tehran sanctions to be removed at once. He cited how the agency, IAEA agency, has made 15 reports, and yet it still has distrust in U.S.'s, in Iran's civilian nuclear program. And we also understand that there are going to be talks. Are there going to be talks where the U.S. has to first remove the sanctions, as Ebrahim Raisi has pointed out, or is that something that's going to be as a precondition after talks begin? A little bit of confusion here as to the direction this is going to go.
Oh, no. The nuclear diplomacy in the talks in Vienna is the product of the whole establishment, of the policies that have been developed by the whole establishment, including the Supreme National Security Council, the leader, the government, the parliament, everyone. Iran had raised several demands right from the beginning of the Vienna talks under President Rouhani, that all post-JCPOA sanctions, as well as those mentioned in the JCPOA, should be removed and annulled forever, first. Second, Iran should be given a period of 3 to 6 months to verify, because the last time we did it under Obama, who was after the nuclear deal, apparently, he defied all his undertakings and he never removed the sanctions in action, but he just did it over the paper. So Iran doesn't want to be fooled or deceived, so he wants time for verification. Now, still, the same rules apply. Iran has the same conditions, no matter if it's a Raisi government, the conditions are the same. What's different is that they are having some kind of, stronger position and stance. While Rouhani was looking at the JCPOA as his, heritage, some kind of legacy, President Raisi has stressed that the JCPOA would not be a pivotal part of Iran's foreign policy under him. So he is going to continue the talks, but he will be more serious about Iranian conditions, and he wants to see the conditions met first. So I do believe that the talks would continue, definitely, but it would not last long because they do not mean to play around. Uh-huh. They are serious, and they don't want to revive the JCPOA at any cost, under any kind of condition. They will, wrap it up fast if they see that the conditions are not met by the United States.
Sure.
And they know how much the United States needs the JCPOA because it is weak, it's moving towards demise, and its power is, decreasing, and their only formula to contain Iran is through the agreements, multiple agreements that they have in mind, and the uh-huh. Iranians are in control.
Sure, that's an important point that he makes there. John White, I don't know if you agree, but I'd like to get your understanding how badly the U.S. needs Iran when it comes to this nuclear deal. I mean, President Joe Biden in his address said that Washington is willing to return to the pact. At the same time, he said if Tehran first suspends its countermeasures taken in response to U.S. violations and reimposition of sanctions. How badly does the U.S. need Iran to come back to this pact? And do you think that it's going to jeopardize this need for Iran to return by not lifting sanctions the way Iran thinks that it should?
Biden administration is in an incredibly weak position, especially for an administration in its early stages. The debacle of Afghanistan has placed a premium on the Biden administration scoring some kind of foreign policy success. So this puts Iran in a very strong position. However, the Biden administration is in an invidious position when it comes to Iran because of the huge anti-Iranian bent of the American security establishment writ large and power of the Israel lobby, which is putting unceasing pressure on the Biden administration to play hardball with Iran. So this is a very interesting time. It's a huge stress test for the Biden administration. The recent establishment of this new military pact between the US, UK and Australia with China in mind is an act of weakness, not strength. And it's quite ludicrous that they're talking about taking on China just weeks after the humiliating debacle of Afghanistan. I think the Biden administration is in crisis already. It has multiplying domestic problems to contend with, the failure of the vaccine take-up, the failure of its ability to pass its program through Congress, despite it being Democratic party-controlled Congress in its first term. I think the Biden administration is against the ropes. The Iranian government has cleverly understood it, now moved into a position of strength, and it's absolutely right that demands the lifting of sanctions as a precondition of talks. It's already made a huge compromise recently with the allowance of the IAEA to reset its monitoring equipment in Iran, but Iran now knows that it has a whip hand, and I think it's all a matter of time before the Biden administration will cave in to Iran's demand, despite the huge Washington establishment pressure for it to do otherwise.
Thank you very much for that. We are fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, John White, speaking there, writer and political analyst from Edinburgh. Thank you. Said Mustafa Khoshesh, many thanks, political analyst who also spoke to us. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kavit Halfway, and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
terrorism. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the 10th episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you Mehrad Hospital, one of Tehran's leading hospitals. Please stay with us. The city of Tehran, with its myriad accommodation and recreational facilities, is the destination of choice for many foreign health tourists who travel to Iran to receive first-class medical care, which is, at the same time, affordable. Many tourists also enjoy the historical and recreational attractions of the Iranian capital once they have completed their medical treatment. Tehran has the largest variety and the greatest concentration of hospitals and clinics anywhere in the country. Among the many hospitals operating in Tehran, Mehrad Hospital is one of the most well-known and is located between Abbasabad and Motahari streets in central Tehran. Mehrad Hospital was officially inaugurated in 1982 in a 5,000 square meter plot of land and has been operating and offering services to patients for more than 36 years. Mehrad Hospital has 200 beds and is one of the top private hospitals in Tehran, which has succeeded in the National Hospital Accreditation to receive the top-notch score from the Ministry of Health and Medical Education of Iran. Accreditation means the systematic evaluation of healthcare centers with specific standards that emphasize on continuous quality improvement, patient orientation, and improvement of patients and patient and staff safety. Mehrad Hospital consists of several buildings. Building number 1 and building number 2, each consisting of 4 floors, as well as a building of specialized and subspecialized clinics, which is located separately next to this complex. There are several inpatient wards in Mehrad Hospital, which include internal medicine, pediatric, neonatal, gynecological, surgical, and other specialized wards. Outpatient departments include angiography, daycare, specialized and subspecialized clinics, emergency room, operating room, delivery block, dialysis, and scoping. Each of these wards provide specialized services to patients. For example, in the daycare ward of Mehrad Hospital, patients who need to be hospitalized for only one day are admitted. The nurses of this ward have special skills in chemotherapy and providing related care to this group of patients. In this ward, various services are provided to patients, including preparing patients for minor and outpatient surgeries, performing chemotherapy, blood transfusion, injection of special drugs for outpatients, etc. are performed in this ward. Mehrad Hospital, due to its appropriate medical facilities and infrastructure, also operates in admitting international patients. In continue, we will discuss the activities of this hospital in the international arena. The most important issues in tourism discussed by the experts of this field is taking into consideration the monetization, income, earning, and employment in tourism. which plays an important role in economic development of countries. Health tourism, as one of the most important branches of tourism, has been able to attract the attention of many countries in recent years. Iran also has paid a special attention to this sector of tourism and has taken valuable measures to make this sector more targeted. One of these measures is the granting of IPD licenses to hospitals. IPD licenses are issued for a limited time to hospitals that meet all the provisions of this license correctly, and it is renewed every year by the Ministry of Health of Iran. Mehrad Hospital is one of the hospitals that has been able to obtain the license from the Ministry of Health. The hospital is general and offers various specialized services to patients, including endocrinology, gastroenterology, rheumatology, neurology, urology, cardiology, infectious lung pediatric, neonatal, orthopedic, ENT, neurology, obstetrics, and gynecology, as well as specialized surgeries being performed in this hospital. About 120 physicians with different specialties and capabilities work in this hospital, and a total of about 700 people in different wards of the hospital are offering services to the clients and patients. Mehrad Hospital also provides medical services to foreign patients before receiving the IPD license. But with the launch of this section, this activity is carried out in a more professional manner and regularly. In the international ward of the hospital, patients are admitted and discharged, and the patient's information is registered in the website of the Ministry of Health of Iran after admission. International patients are welcomed from the very beginning of their stay in the hospital and are accompanied by the experts of this department, and they are taken care of during the whole period of the patient's treatment. During the hospitalization, if the patient needs anything, it will be provided by experts fluent in English in the same department. Foreign patients, after ongoing treatment and traveling to their home country, are still followed up by the experts of this department to ensure that the patient's physical condition is appropriate. Dear listeners, you can get more information about the cost of medical treatment and the medical services on offer through the hospital's website at http://en.mehradhospital.com. You can also phone Mehrad Hospital directly on 0098-2174-018874. You can also ask your questions by email. The hospital email address is ipd@mehradhospital.com. Dear listeners, that was the 10th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.